All right, fellas, welcome to another Champion Hope podcast. It has been a few weeks between vacation and August and getting school started again, but we're going to be back in the throes of it. Got a couple of great guests lined up, but I want to jump straight into the day with my new friend, Chris Bruno. He is a man's man. He is pursuing the heart of men, and more importantly, he is helping men live wholehearted in the way of the kingdom for God. He has a recent book out called Sage, A Man's Guide into His Second Passage. So Chris, welcome to the Champion Hope podcast.
Lance, thanks so much. It's great to be here with you today.
Absolutely. I know we're going to dive in, and sometimes people leave at the end or like telling us where you're at. But Restoration Project, and you said the Restory Counseling.
Yep.
Okay. So you have a dynamic story as I've jumped into the book. What I find interesting is, right, you're targeting this very specific, this very niche market, men in their 40s, 50s in general with this book. But I can't tell you how often, right, men are on this desert journey of trying to figure out what this season of life looks like. Will you kind of just share with us, how did you stumble across like this message of Sage, one from a personal perspective?
Yeah, well, I'll start there. I mean, in a few months, I turned 50. And so back when I turned 40, I was at that place in my life of, hey, things are happening. I have a full family. I'm full in that like fathering space with these kids at home, and I'm investing a lot in them. I'm trying to invest in my marriage. I'm trying to invest in my business and my ministry and all those things. And so as a 40-year-old, it was like high output. And I think that's common for a lot of guys that were, you know, in that 35 to 45, 50-year range. It's like, there's a lot of high output. And Lance, what began to happen to me when I shifted over into that, you know, when I hit that 40 mark, it's not like anything magical happened, but I tend to be more of a reflective person. And so I was like, okay, here I am at 40. And what do I want both the next decade and the next decades of my life to look like? Because I can't continue this level of high output forever. And I actually don't even think it's something that I'm called to do. Because I think we as men feel like, okay, the pinnacle of our lives is when we hit that king stage of our lives, where it's like, I'm ruling my domain and I have my kingdom, and that's the fullness of who I am. I actually believe, Lance, that it's the next stage after king that is the fullness, the pinnacle of what God calls us to as men and as women. But since, you know, my audience and our audience is generally towards men, that is what the pinnacle of manhood is. So for me, it was some rumblings inside of my soul. It was some awareness of, where have I been? And especially, where am I going? And I want to be an intentional man in all the spaces of my life. And so as I hit that 40-year mark, and a few years after, some friends and I were sitting around a campfire talking about these things. And literally we're like, what are we going to do for our second half? What intentional movement do we want to make as we kind of go through this decade of midlife into this second half of our lives? That's really the genesis of where Sage came from.
I love it. We're going to dive into what you've kind of framed as six stages of the man, and I'll have you frame those up here in a few moments. But one of the first curious questions that I often ask guests is, just tell us about your wife. What's a recent date that you have been on? And just share what that experience was like.
Yeah, great question. So I've been married to my wife, Beth, for 27 years, and we have three kids. Our youngest is 16. We have a 19-year-old and a 22-year-old. So they're all on the older end. And a recent date, I'm trying to think of, we've done a couple recently. One of them, well, first of all, we just love to travel together. And so if we can go a little bit lower on the expenditure around dates and a little bit higher on the expenditure with travel, that will be always our default. So we love to do that. A recent date would be, we live in Colorado, and so we have some mountain property that's just kind of vacant. And over the course of the summer, we had a vintage 1967 trailer that was like our COVID project that we bought in 2020. We refurbished it and used it. But because it was A, so old, B, so heavy, and C, so small, I could not stand up in it. I sold it at the beginning of the summer and basically, you know, and then bought a pop-up camper that was more of an outdoor kind of, you can get around in it kind of vehicle. And so a recent date was for us just to sneak away for a night up to the mountains and give our pop-up camper a maiden voyage of just being out in the woods and seeing what it was like. And I ended up actually realizing, like, I love this. I love what I just purchased. And so it was great. My wife and I love to sit out with charcuterie and a glass of wine or a glass of whiskey or something and just sit under the stars. And so that was a recent date for us. She had actually been gone traveling for a good portion of the summer. She led a women's trip called the Lost Women of Turkey and took a group of women overseas. And so she had just come back. So this is kind of like a special reconnecting, like, hey, I'm still here and you're still here and let's get into the fall. So that was one of our most recent dates.
That's good. That's good. I know probably in the arena that you serve in the office and the men that you encounter and their stories. And I just think it's so important, like, right, the heart of pursuing our spouse, if we're married, reflects so much about who we are and who we're becoming. Because I don't know why we forget as men that, like, we still need to romance and pursue her, right? So I think it's always just helpful to have encouraging stories, because many men are like, well, what do I do? Well, it's as simple as a charcuterie board and just enjoying the presence of one another, right? Like,
and don't overcomplicate these
things. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Sitting in a camp chair outside with a charcuterie board. Like, it doesn't take much, guys.
Yeah. It's just the same intentionality. Keep it going.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, I want to hear about the six stages and maybe frame it in the context, because another question I often ask is, like, one of your dark seasons of life, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is not just an accidental work, right? God did something in you and through you to bring this book to fruition. So what are the six stages? Mm-hmm. And possibly just share one nugget out of one of those stages that was meaningful for you, other than the sage stage.
Yeah. So, the sage is the sixth stage. So it's the final kind of stage. And I feel like even in there's some, you know, sub stages and whatever. I don't want to get into all that, but the first five, Lance, are really in the first half of our lives, or into the first half of our lives. And in the book, I walk through this and I even say, you know, hey, this is an amalgamation of a lot of wisdom that comes from many other people, and even over the course of time and from the scriptures. But the way that I've described it is the first stage, or first of all, let me just describe it as concentric circles. So, like a target that, you know, there's an inner circle and then it kind of works outwards. So each stage subsumes the previous one. And then the next one comes and it subsumes the previous ones. So it's an ever-growingness and ever-increasingness of us as men. And if you just think of like the cross-section of a tree, where on the outside of the tree is the adult tree that you see, but on the inside are the rings of the tree, which is really all the ages that we have been before and all the experiences we still hold within us. And they still inform us for the next stage, but, you know, we've matured, we've grown, and in many ways gotten bigger in who we are. And so the first stage is what I call the innocent boy. And this is when you first arrive on the scene. You're this, you know, little boy. Just think of like a 3, 4, 5-year-old boy who's learning how to, you know, run through the sprinklers with his shirt off and scream on, you know, jump on the trampoline, and just this innocence to him. And when I say the word innocent, I mean that there's kind of two meanings to that. First of all, that there is a not guilty, and you're innocent of crime. And then secondly, that innocent also means naive. And in the innocent stage, I mean far more around the naive. Now, granted, you know, a five-year-old is, we all know our kids are, they do things and they're sinful and they, you know, they make mistakes and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying that they're not guilty of any sin at all, but generally the major egregious sins, you know, they're not there, but primarily they're the innocent in the naive. They don't know much about the world, and darkness and evil and trauma have yet to visit their world, their story. So they're innocent in that stage. And so, I mean, I can remember for me, you know, I grew up with dogs. And so I can remember playing with the dogs. I can remember going into my dad and I built a dog house, and he wasn't willing to invest in paint for the dog house. So the only paint that we had in the house was pink. And so I painted this dog house pink for myself and my two male dogs. And we would go in this really super tiny dog house, and I would just be in, you know, in the doghouse with them and just cuddle with them. And I'd make up stories about the adventures that we were on, all that with the dogs. That's the innocent stage. Okay. Then after that is, as you can imagine, is the kind of growing into that adolescent time period. And I call that the phallic man. And what I mean by that is, yes, so things in puberty and sexually and all those kinds of things are developing, but far more there's an awareness of myself as and sexuality of myself and what I'm feeling and desire and arousal and all those things. My new senses are kind of woken up in both my body and my heart. And so that's the phallic stage. And you can imagine all the things that are part and parcel of that. You know, you start noticing girls and you start going on dates and you start having crushes and you start having your heart broken and you start having all these dreams of marriage and whatever in that phallic stage. And so in that place, right, just remembering for me the, you know, the first girlfriend and the first experience of, you know, what is it like to kiss somebody, and, you know, kind of discovering like, oh, this thing in my pants does more than pee and all that kind of thing. So that's the phallic stage of that awakening, that sexual awakening. After that is the warrior, right? And if you can kind of imagine like that 20 something, even 30 something, where you're heading out, you're launched out of the house. And now it is, I have a battle to fight. I have a place to go. I mean, you can hear some of the language of other authors in what I'm saying. Like we have a hill to conquer. And whether that hill is a ministry, a business, a bank account, you know, whatever that is, a community, whatever that is, there's a hill for us to go fight. And along with that comes some battles. Where I'm going to fight some battles and some darkness even. For me, that stage involved going on staff with a international Christian ministry. And then my wife and I served overseas in the Middle East for 10 years. And we went to the largest unreached country in the world, right? It had to be the most difficult and the you know, all that. And so that was, as I was a 25-year-old, you know, to 35-year-old, that was the battle that I was fighting. And it wasn't against the people. It was against, you know, just like, hey, I want to bring the light of God to this part of the world. So that's the third stage. But again, as you can imagine, as a warrior, you're going to be wounded. There's going to be things that happen on the battlefield. And you can press through some of those flesh wounds, if you will, but somewhere along the way, you get fully knocked off your horse. There's fully something that happens that just kind of takes you out, and you have to leave the field to go back to the infirmary, if you will. And the woundedness of our lives is actually an important stage of a man's life. It's one that we want to... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. What age frame do you typically kind of talk about the warrior stage?
The warrior stage, yeah, somewhere between like 20 and 35 or whatever. And I'll say with all of these, I think we can get stuck in a stage and we don't move on to the next one because A, it's fulfilling, or B, we've become addicted to something. You know, in the sexuality, you can imagine there's addictions that come with that. But even in the warrior stage, like there's the adrenaline rush. There's the addiction to work. There's the addiction to working out. There's the addiction to money. Those things that, that kind of keep us in the warrior stage. So these are general as far as ages. I've known 65-year-old warriors and I've known 25-year-old wounded men. It just is kind of how the story unfolds that God is telling in our lives. So we get to the wounded stage, and that's usually somewhere in the, 30 to 40, maybe 45-year-old range of I've been knocked off my horse. And we see this all throughout the scriptures of literally when Saul turns into Paul and Simon turns into Peter, and we have, these whole transformations of men that they have to actually wrestle with God throughout the darkness, and they have a woundedness that happens and they get a new name. And in this work, a lot of guys I see fall into either I resist the woundedness. I don't want to embrace it or acknowledge it, and I deny it, or I wallow in the midst of it. And it just becomes this kind of quiet desperation that we just kind of sit in, and it's just, woe is me. This is my life. I guess this is what's going to happen to me the rest of my life. Yeah. And people like you kind of come alongside of them and help them break through, I think, a lot of some of that. But for me, the wounded stage was, here I was serving in international missions in the Middle East. A couple things happened, which I've written about in other places. Once I was attacked actually on the street and was stabbed. And that woke me up to some realities of, I had the recovery physically, but I also, more importantly, had the recovery of my heart in what was happening in the midst of that. Some significant things that happened in our marriage as a result, but then also had some significant persecution and loss in the midst of the ministry that we were trying to do, that there was some significant persecution that cost us significantly with regard to the ministry, but then also a couple of our staff lost their lives as a result. And so I was the leader of the organization at that point, and it just bottomed me out. And so I came back to the States and had to really find my feet again and be in the wounded stage for a significant season. It was almost like 3 years of having to sit with like, what just happened in the past, and who am I now? So the fifth stage, go ahead.
Well, go finish 5 and 6, and I want to kind of come back to the wounded just for sure. A few moments.
Yeah. So the fifth stage is what I would call the restored king. And that, Lance, is when someone walks through the depths of, the dark night of the soul of the wounded man, and kind of comes back to himself in some ways, where he's no longer living for somebody on the outside, but he has settled something on the inside. And he's reestablished himself. He has the wisdom of experience. He has some age under his belt. He has some, exposure to the world. And he now kind of steps into his own. And I once had a friend of mine tell me, kind of, when you're early, 20s and 30s, you're exploring the world, but really you don't come to know who you are as a man until you are in your 40s. And that's when you start to do the things that you know are the things that you're here to do. And that's the king. So he establishes the domain, he sits down on his throne, he kind of creates for himself a way that he's going to live life and all of that. And that is what I did after stepping out of the wounded stage. I had gone to grad school during that time. And that's when I started Restoration Project and Restory Counseling. And like, okay, here is what I am about. Here is what I am setting my sights on, and the kind of the kingdom that I'm going to build. After that is the sage, the wise sage. And here's where like all of those stages you can see kind of happen really from 0 to maybe 50, maybe 60, before you kind of hit the wise sage. But and even all the way up until the 80-year mark, people can be in the first half of their lives up until they pass, because the shift is stepping into the sage. And the way that I talk about it in the book is this, that if the first passage of a man's life is going from boy to man, so the first passage is to find the man within the boy and call that man forth so that he can live all of that, you know, man life that we are meant to live. That's the first passage. The second passage is finding the boy still within the man and bringing him home, bringing him back to himself in some significant ways that all those previous stages have informed, and the wisdom that he has and the subtleness that he has in the fact that he no longer needs to kind of prove himself or whatever. There's this kind of homecoming of all those broken and wounded parts of himself. That's the wise sage. And last thing I'll say about the sage is that in almost every story, we have a hero behind the hero. And the hero is the one that most stories focus on, right? We've got, you know, the story of Lord of the Rings is Frodo. The story of Gladiator is Maximus, right? The story of Harry Potter is Harry Potter. But behind each one of those guys that is the hero, there is another man that's standing there. There is a wise sage that is standing behind the hero, that when the sage's hand is on that hero's back, and he gives that both his presence and his wisdom and the kind of the spaciousness of heart that he brings to that younger man, that is what actually makes that younger man a hero. It's actually what sets the course for some really amazing things to happen. But unless we intend to move from that king into the sage, it just won't happen. We just find comfort. We find our way kind of through life and just continue on and believe that the next thing that's available for us is retirement and golf course. So
I'm going to get to that as well.
So
let me ask you, you share in the book, you know, and this happens so often, this is why I'm bringing it up, right out of the gate, right? You're climbing the corporate ladder and having phenomenal success, right? Mm-hmm. And then the transition into this nonprofit world and you realize, like, people are like, oh, I'm pretty good at what I do. And you start having more success. And what I've found to be true, and I don't know where I first stumbled across this age or if I made it up, but in general, right, the wounded stage, what I tell men is that's typically 36, give or take 5 years on either side, something's going to happen. One, you can either prepare for it, ignore it, keep going, but something's going to happen that's going to knock you off your horse, as you say, and it's your opportunity to either react to that or allow God to redeem something that he's pursuing. Mm-hmm. And maybe I say 36 because that's when it happened to me. So it may be personal, but what I find to be true also is that there's so many men, Christian, non-Christian, that happens, and as you've already said, that they just keep repeating the cycle, like, right? Like, it could be the story of the millionaire who's made millions, lost millions, he keeps doing the same thing, gets a divorce, gets another divorce. Like, what is it that sets men apart when they get knocked off their horse that they're like, I want to be redeemed here, like, I want to become a wholehearted person, right? Mm-hmm. Because if anything comes out of this, I think there's so many men struggling right now that they need to pay attention to those small little nudges that are saying, like I'm pursuing you and you're worth pursuing. So, like, what's the difference in men who say, you know what, I'm not giving up just yet, right? Yeah. Like, what have you found is a difference in guys who are trying to truly live with their whole heart when they do get knocked off the horse?
I believe, Lance, that I think there's a lot of differences, and I think it's far too much that we can discuss here, but probably the primary one that comes to mind is that there is something about that man that kind of recognizes he's come to the end of himself. And what I mean by that is that it's not just a knock off the horse, like that was a bad day or that was a bad business venture, but there's something internally that he recognizes, like the sense that who I am is actually not enough for this world. Who I am and what I bring is actually not enough. Yet all, the whole world wants us to believe that I'm a self-made man. and I can do it all. And it's really a blow to the ego. It's a blow to the heart, but it's also a blow to the sense of like, I just have come to the end of my own rope, and there is no more rope for me to tie another knot to try to hang in even more. And so I'm at the end, and I have to let go. And it's right there in that space that I think that when we come to the end of ourselves and what we believe, that change is actually possible and growth is actually possible, because we're at the threshold of faith. I think a lot of Christians believe that faith is a matter of believing certain truths. And I believe that faith is a matter of taking certain steps that are beyond what I can understand and see. And when we're in that kind of realm, now we're in the realm of some deeper faith of like, I have to believe that God is actually who he says he is. I have to believe that I am not all that there is, and I am not all even that I believed that I was. So that's the difference.
I may be oversimplifying this. I'm a simpleton at heart, but like, right, so much of it, it's like you got to believe that change is possible, yeah. Right? That transformation is possible. Otherwise, you're going to keep trying to fix and change by all the external realities, mm-hmm. and they're just going to keep leaving you a little bit more empty, a little bit more empty, right? So maybe it is as simple as just the belief that there's something in you that God is trying to nurture and grow, that like, no, transformation is still possible this side of heaven.
Mm-hmm. 100%, 100%. And that's the nature of hope. That's the nature of hope, is believing that something is possible, even when it's ridiculous to believe that. And, you know, in my mind, hope is defiance against kind of the narratives that we have come to believe about ourselves, either that we can't do it or we can do it. And it eliminates out all the possibility of change and transformation. So I 100% believe what you're saying.
So I've asked this question here recently to some guys, 70 plus in general, who in my perspective, at least they still have this gusto about them in life, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe we shift the conversation a little bit about Sage. Like these men that are still living with their whole heart versus men who are living in the lazy boy. In your experience, like what's the differentiation, you know, there as well?
Yeah. I mean, every single one of us, if we have the privilege of living that long on earth, every single one of us will become elderly unless we choose to become an elder. And that there's a big difference in my mind of what those two things are. And I love how you just put that, the gusto of life. And that is, as I believe, the pinnacle of manhood is as an elder in the world. And biblically, it talks about how these elders are kind of like the pylons of society. And maybe they didn't work. I'm not saying that you work until you die, but you contribute to the world and to the life and to your family and to the goodness of the kingdom of God in the world. That's the gusto that I hear you talking about. Unless we're intentional about this second passage, unless we're intentional about making this movement into becoming a sage, we will just become old men. And maybe we're sitting in the lazy boy like you talk about. Maybe we're on the golf course. Maybe we are playing with the grandchildren and kind of doing what on the outside feels and looks like a good and present man, but there's something significant that I believe God has for each one of us to contribute to the world. That's not our advice. That's not just giving advice to a younger generation. I don't know how many older men assume that what I want from them is advice. That's what YouTube is for. Right? That's what I can go and get information from someone else about how to something. What I want from an older man is his presence. I want his face. I want his words. I want his hospitality. I want his to sit with me in the midst of my suffering. That's what I want from that older man. And that's what a sage is, not someone who's just old and gives advice.
So speak to for example, the average man who could be listening to this, saying he's 45, done well, he's got the corner office, and possibly he's somewhere in that wounded season. He's trying to come out of the wounded season. Like what is your wisdom to kind of transition, right? Like, as you kind of so well framed and sage, and helping the essence of men really come alive. I hate saying steps, right? Because our faith journey is not a linear process. But like, what are steps that a person who's seeking health could begin to take?
Yeah. Well, in the book, I talk about these two concepts. One is called projections, and one is called personas. And so if you kind of just imagine, probably the best way is if you can imagine you standing with one hand of yours over your own face and the other hand of yours on the face of another person. So like you're putting a mask on another person and you're putting a mask on yourself. Projections are the mask that I'm putting on other people. So where is my identity? How have I allowed other people to give me a sense of purpose and identity that's on the outside? What other faces have I looked to on the outside of me to tell me who I am on the inside of me? That's a projection. A persona is the mask that I put on myself that is who I have become as a result. So maybe I'm the highly successful businessman. Maybe I'm the jokester. Maybe I'm the biker guy. Maybe I'm the outdoorsman. Like, you know, and maybe I'm the good Christian guy. Maybe I'm the rebel Christian guy. I mean, I don't know. Those are the personas that we often put on ourselves, because what we get from acting in those ways, becoming those actors with that mask on, is affirmation and validation and appreciation and all the things that feel really good. So the more I act that way, my world responds to me in a way that validates who I am. So to answer your question, I bring those two things up, that as a 45-year-old, and whether you're, you know, in that wounded man stage or the restored king stage or wherever you are, the question that I would have for you is, where are you looking for your identity? Where on the outside of you are you looking for that validation and affirmation and a sense of purpose? So an example is, like, you know, I've worked with lots of guys, and there's the dad who has the son who's on the high school football team. And when the son is on the high school football team and he's, you know, that dad is like vicariously reliving through all the goodness that he experienced as a boy. Now he's got it in his son. And however good that son does on the team means that man, that dad, is a good dad. Or however well-behaved your children are in church, or however big your bank account is, or however successful your business is, those are indications. That's where you look for identity to give you validation as a man. So I'd ask that, like, where are you looking externally for that? And then also, what masks are you putting on yourself to amplify a sense of your own well-being? And what happens if you begin to take that mask off? Who are you behind the mask? Who did God originally create you to be? And what would it look like for you to slowly start to identify the masks you wear and take them off, and identify the masks you look to that you've put on other people and take those off? What are you left with then? That, I think, is what midlife, and especially midlife crisis, is about. Is the crisis comes in when my masks no longer work. When I don't, you know, if the last car that I bought or the last woman that I was with didn't do it for me, I'm going to go to another one and another one and another one. That's the crisis. It's a crisis of identity. It's a crisis of personas and projections. So where are you looking externally, and what might still be possible for you if you actually looked at the man God made and designed?
It sounds, I mean, literally, I was on the phone with someone an hour before this, and the words I used, it's like, you sound exhausted. Like, right? Like, that's kind of what I hear by the different masks that you're talking about, right? The one on yourself and the one on other people. It's like, how long can you keep doing this, right? And the words I use was like, you can't get your identity from all these things around you. Like, and I don't know why, like, it's our sinful side, right? But we do it and we keep doing it.
Well, I would say, yeah, it's our sinful side, but here's the thing, Lance, is that they work. And some of the restory work that we do, where we're helping people kind of read their past in order to really write their future, is to go back to that little boy of where those personas and projections began. And what if, instead of being judgmental towards him, what if you were actually kind and generous towards him to say, hey, that was what you needed to do to survive XYZ in your family of origin, in the world, you know, in friendships, whatever, in the trauma that you experienced, you had to develop those personas in order to make it. And you come now to midlife and you're still wearing your childhood persona. What would it look like for you to address that now and put it down? Because I think the guys that are 60, 70, 80 years old, 50, 40, whatever, into their, you know, well into their adult years, that are still living their first half life, is that they're still living with their childhood personas. And they think it still works. And we all can see the emperor has no clothes. Like, we see that and we feel it.
And it's that subconscious, that transference, right? Like we don't know why we're angry at our 11-year-old son in this moment. But I'm like, hey, hold on just a moment. Let me just share one little nugget with you. Like what's happening is this transference thing. Like, right. So just bring that subconscious up a little bit, you know, because most men who are listening to this desire so much more for their life, to love their family well, and, you know, love those that they serve well. But there is so much happening underneath the surface that we rarely slow down and talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always more to the story.
So for you, Chris, right, you're on the cusp of 50, not quite 50, right?
Yep.
What are you changing? What are you, like, personally, like, how are you growing? What is God trying to pull in your life? What are you trying to let go of? What's going on with you?
Yeah. So In the personal side, the inner world side of me. And I think, you know, this has been this decade-long journey since I did turn 40, and specifically, you know, really starting when I was about 44, was trying to identify, and for those that are not familiar with, like, counseling terms or psychology terms, this might sound a little psychobabble for you, but just hang with me in this realm. But there's, just as there are those rings of the trees we talked about, like, there are, living within inside of us, there are all the little boys that we have ever been, and all the younger men that we have ever been. And for many of those parts of us, we're disgusted by them. We're ashamed of them. We've exiled them. We deny them. We kind of bury them in the backyard, kind of things. And I feel like some of the work of moving into the place of sage in this projections and personas piece is, when I take those masks off, what little younger parts of me do I find? And that's why I say, kind of, the task of the second half is to find the boy within the man and bring that boy home, because the ultimate person to care for us, me, the little boys inside of me, is me. And I think we all live our lives believing that someone else is going to come and do that work for us. And whether that's a boss or a wife or a child or a job, right, or a car, or, you know, whatever, it's, no one's going to come. That person that's going to come for those parts of you that have been lost or wounded or traumatized, whatever it is, if we can tend to those parts of our own hearts, that, I think, is where we can come home, like I said, to ourselves. And so for me, the last couple of years have been becoming friends with myself, with those parts of me, with the parts of me that are still stuck in that phallic stage, still stuck in that that wounded stage, still stuck in that innocent stage. Lance, just a couple of days ago, I was on a walk, and actually on a hike here in Colorado, and I was alone. It was a day that everybody else was kind of elsewhere, and I just took the opportunity to go on a hike. And I spent some time thinking about the athletic boy inside of me. So I grew up in the mountains of Colorado, And there was, and we lived 45 minutes away from the junior high and high school. And so sports for me was not possible because I couldn't get to or from school without a ride. And so often, like now in the world of men, it's all about, you know, ESPN and sports and football and all those kinds of things. I cannot participate in those conversations just because I couldn't get to those places. And I didn't fall in love with football because I wasn't playing it. So I never watched it and all that kind of stuff. So I spent some time with myself around the athletic boy inside of me that never was seen, I never had a coach. I never had a father or a mother, or even friends that were aware of this part of me that loves to be active and loves to be outside and loves to do those kinds of things. But I never had someone's kind of speaking into that. And so therefore on this hike just a few days ago, it was me spending time with that athletic part of me, kind of both lamenting what wasn't, recognizing what was, and then taking myself on a hike because I love to do those kinds of things and tending to that part of me and bringing that part of me home. That's the kind of work that I think I've been involved in the last couple of years and some of what I call Guys to Unsage.
The phrase and just the way you said that, like, right, just learning to be a friend to yourself. Mm-hmm. Like if those who are listening will just stop and like ponder like that, like on another level, it reminds me just of that non-judgmental self-compassion, right? Like, but what you're talking about is so foreign because like, how do I make time for myself? How do I invest in myself? Am I worth going on a hike by myself? Like, right? Like, that's kind of a foreign concept to become a friend to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But that's extremely helpful.
And being by yourself can be terrifying. Because we're not friends with ourselves. And I think one of the signature things that a sage actually has in his heart and in his life is this movement from loneliness into a place of solitude. And that in solitude, it's actually, there's a lot of people there. And those people are God and all those younger parts of you. So you can be with yourself and enjoy yourself. Like, I like me, kind of a thing. And, but you know, it's not a matter of introversion versus extroversion. It's a matter of, am I at home even inside my own heart?
I want to be mindful of your time and just those who are listening. What does it mean for you, to be a champion, and specifically, what does it mean for you to like champion hope?
Lance, the thing that I've endeavored to do, and so my first book was about the first rite of passage. This is about the second rite of passage, is to live life out loud. And so I've been very upfront. Like, I am on the front end of this with Sage, and I am turning 50 in a few months. And I've been, you know, thinking about this for a long time, but I'm not fully past that threshold. I'm not in the midst of it. I can't say like when I became a sage, I am in the process of becoming a sage.
Right.
So for me to champion hope means to live life out loud and have a sense of like honesty of where I am, an awareness of where I am, which is probably even harder than the honesty piece. And then a kindness towards where I am. Like, hey, I've never done this before. I've never turned 50 before. I've never become a sage before. So what does this mean for me to do so in the way that God's called me to do that? And that's kind of what I mean by when I hear championing hope is to sit in the place of honesty and honor, which are interestingly related words, of where I am and where I see myself going, and to do so kind of out loud in a way that invites people in. So
that's good. Thank you. You've mentioned several helpful things, solitude, becoming a friend to yourself, story, writing your story, future story, all those things. Leave us with like one more just golden nugget wisdom. Like, what else have you found helpful maybe for yourself or the men that you serve, just as they're navigating maybe one of these six stages, or possibly they're right here in the midst of this sage stage? Like, what's just kind of helpful right now?
Well, in my mind, I go to a passage in Ephesians chapter 2 where Paul talks about that we are the workmanship of God. and that we were created in Christ Jesus to do good works. And that whole passage, Lance, is, you know, right before that, Paul talks about how it's not, God's not actually interested in the works that we do that will be saving. It's not by faith that we are saved. But then he goes right on to say, hey, but it's, you know, you were created to do some good works. That word workmanship in really the original Greek is the word poema. And you might have heard this before, but it's the word where we get in English, the word for poetry. And so if you think about that passage, so we are the poetry of God, created or written in Christ Jesus to bring goodness to the world. And so for me, when I think about, as I am becoming a sage, who am I becoming? It's actually living more into the poem, the workmanship, other translations say handiwork or masterpiece of God. It's more returning back to my original design than it is becoming something, which I've endeavored most of my life to become something. It's actually going back to what God designed me to become versus what I have endeavored to become. And so for me, the beautiful part of that is created in Christ Jesus to do the good works that he actually put inside of me to bring to the world. And so I think some of the excavation and the archaeology that we can do in our own lives is not what was I meant, what was I put here to do, but who was I put here to be? What masterpiece was I put on earth to be and bring to the world? And that I think is really a calling to, and why we call it restory, this whole idea of going back to the original story and unpacking, you know, when I was that boy, when I was that young man, who was I designed to be and how can I actually become more him than all the other things, trauma and not trauma that have happened in my life that I've identified myself with so significantly.
Thank you for sharing and reminding us that. Just reminds me of really what God has been up to in the last 2 months of my life. Just so many men, this is at large, right? But it's also my own heart. It's like this whole social media thing, this whole being on our phone, like, man, it's just hijacked us in profound ways, hijacked me in profound ways. But sometime this summer, I made a screensaver and I said on the screensaver, who am I becoming right now by opening my phone? That has sent me on all these small transformative things that, like, man, this addiction, these dopamine hits in my brain and my heart have become less, right? But unless we bring these questions to the forefront, like you're mentioning, and just say, like, this question that Chris is saying, like, who am I becoming? Is a helpful question just to keep asking over and over and over. Just invite God into that space and see what God can do over a small season. So thank you for reminding us of that.
Absolutely.
So, Chris, would you do us an honor and just close us in a word of prayer, maybe a scripture that's on your heart as well?
You bet. God, as we continue to become the men that you designed us to be, God, I pray for three things. One is, I pray that you would bring us an awareness of what is actually going on in our lives and how much we look to the external to give us a sense of who we are. God, I pray that we would be aware of the moving of your spirit in our lives today, that you are never dormant, that you are never absent, that you are always present. And so I pray that you would bring some awareness to us of where you are in our lives. And then secondly, that with that awareness, God, that you would bring us curiosity. That you'd bring us curiosity rather than judgment, rather than disgust, rather than contempt, but you would bring us to the place of really the posture of Jesus, of being curious about what is happening here. What is the story behind the story? And who am I in this moment? Like, what is actually happening for me? Some curiosity. And then with that curiosity, the third thing, God, would you bring us kindness? It is the kindness of God that leads us to repentance. It is the kindness of God that leads us to transformation and shame and relief from our shame. It's the kindness of God that brings us to change. And so, God, I pray that in awareness and curiosity and kindness that you would move us closer to the heart of Jesus and closer to the heart of the man that you made us to be. So, Father, bless us with your fathering and bring us into your heart as we learn to father the boys within our own hearts. In your name, amen.